This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Concord resident Virginia McGregor's latest novel, Before I Was Yours, is the story of a young Kenyan boy, Jonah, who is brought to England under mysterious circumstances by a friend of his mother's. He's abandoned at the airport and, after a stint in foster care, starts living with two would-be adoptive parents who are desperate for a child. But Jonah, as polite and well-behaved as he is, comes with his own set of complications, prompting the adoptive parents to question their ability to be parents at all. McGregor is here with me now to talk about her novel. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
This question comes up again and again in this novel. Am I fit to be a parent? The couple trying to adopt Jonah, their names are Sam and Rosie, wonder at each turn whether they're cut out for the job. Why did you choose to explore this question in your novel?
For several reasons, really. I think it's a question that any of us who have children, whether biological or not, ask ourselves every single day, because it's one of the most testing things in the world. And it's the thing that we are least prepared for. We can have a million degrees and we can have important jobs and feel like we have reached a level of maturity in life, and our children completely floor us and I think make us wonder constantly whether we are fit. But I think this is particularly true of adoptive parents, and it's something that I find, you know, very moving, but also, you know, quite sad that parents who adopt, many of whom have been through years of infertility where they've been questioning their role as parents anyway, all of a sudden enter adoption, and there they have to prove themselves over and over again to social workers and other authorities, as being fit parents. And I often joke that, you know, that you don't have someone with a clipboard knocking on your door, bedroom door, when you're about to conceive a child with your husband. But these adoptive parents, they have to, you know, some of them said to me, we feel we have to be experts in certain areas, particularly because some of the adoptive children come to them with psychological or physical baggage. And so it's something I wanted to question, especially from the point of view of adoption, that these parents have had to prove themselves to be exceptional parents. But even then, there's nothing that quite prepares you for that. So parenthood in general, but for those who adopt in particular.
And talk about having to prove themselves. I mean, in one part in this book, early in the book, there's a sort of party. It's not a typical adoption party, which celebrates the completion of an adoption, but almost like speed dating between, you know, prospective adoptive parents and children who are looking for parents, children trying to find the right match for them, parents trying to find the right match for them. And that is quite a performance in your novel, especially because the parents are all dressed up like cartoon characters or stuffed animals.
So this was probably one of the most exceptional experiences in my research. I contacted an adoption social worker in England who works with the British Association of Adoption and Fostering. And I asked her whether I could attend an adoption party, which I'd heard about through prospective adopters. And I was sure she was going to say no. It's a very emotional day. It's a very personal day. The last thing they want is a novelist nosying around with a notebook. But when I talked to her about, you know, the motivation behind my writing and the nature of my story, magically, she was one of those yes people and said, yes, do come along, but obviously be discreet. And it was just incredible. I went to London, and every time there's a different theme. So the theme when I went was a jungle theme. Sometimes it's based on a particular film that the children like. You know, I'm sure there have been Let It Go themes, or I think there was Toy Story. There's a very moving story of that the social worker told me of how there was an adult, a single male, who came dressed as Woody. I think that's right, isn't it? Woody, a character from Toy Story. And there was a little boy who came because he'd chosen that character too. And they clocked each other right at the beginning. And by the end of the adoption party, the little boy was sitting on his lap and they became father and son eventually, which is one of those kind of magical stories. But it was such an eye-opener. So you bring together these very nervous adopters who have kind of passed a lottery. They can only, I think they're about 20 couples for 60 children, something like that. And then there are activities set up all around the room. It always tends to end with a magic show. The magician does it for free. He is the magician to the queen, apparently. He does children's parties for her and he gives her services free for that. And it ends with a big magic show. And the idea behind it, some people are very critical. They think, oh, this is a puppy show and it's about parents coming to kind of pick their ideal child. It's not like that at all. The idea behind it, and it's an American concept originally, I think, adoption parties, is that there needs to be chemistry between two people for the relationship to work. And adoption social workers spend a lot of time with paper trying to match children with prospective adopters. So they look at their background, they look at their interests, they look at all sorts of things. But actually, paper's not necessarily going to tell you whether there's that magic connection between a child and a parent. And it is quite incredible to watch how, you know, at the beginning it's quite awkward, but gradually through the various activities, some of the children and the parents begin to bond. And I gather that the success rate of those matches is much higher than when children are placed purely based on kind of paperwork and so on. So it was a pretty incredible day, I found. And I gather it is a successful method of bringing children and parents together.
Mm-hmm. So in your research for this book, that is in large part about adoption, what were your big takeaways about the adoption system?
I felt that, like I said, that perhaps there was too much red tape. I know that it is absolutely vital that we check and double check the suitability of prospective adopters, but it feels as though they have to jump through a million hoops before they get to a child. And the problem with that is that, you know, there's the heartache for them, but also that the children in the adoption process are getting older and older. It's very hard to adopt a baby or a small child. And sometimes these children spend years in the adoption system before they are matched. And I think the whole system felt to me in England anyway, you know, quite slow because the checking is so rigorous. And as I said, as biological parents, yes, we have the same genes, but it is quite a lottery, you know, what kind of child you'll have, what kind of character they'll come out with, whether you'll be able to manage them. So I would like to see them coming together a bit more swiftly. I also realized that for the children in the adoption service, particularly those who get adopted very late, and quite a few of them were quite old already at the adoption party, it's very sad. There's a sort of disillusionment that some of these children feel that somehow they're not good enough to be picked, or that somehow they're never going to find their forever family. And so they do arrive in these families sometimes very cautious or skeptical. And that's something no child should ever feel, I think. So it's hard. It's a difficult process. And I think everyone's working as hard as possible to make it work. But there are many sad stories too.
Mm-hmm. We ask authors for this segment to share reading recommendations. Yes. One of the books that you recommended is Beloved by Toni Morrison. And in that book, a mother is haunted by the ghost of her child whom she killed so the child would not have to grow up in slavery. And I thought this was an interesting choice, in part because your novel deals with a similar question. You know, what difficult things are you willing to do to do what's best for your child? Now, Beloved, obviously, Setha chooses a horrifying path. Yes. But the question at the heart of that novel also seems to be very important to this book, Before It Was Yours.
Yeah.
Am I off base there?
No, that's a wonderful connection. And that is the question we always ask. And I think that's the big nature-nurture, biological, non-biological child question, that people who have biological children think they would, you know, they would lay themselves down in the middle of a road to save a child, or run into a burning building, that they would give up their lives for their children. And I certainly feel that for my own children. And the question then is, would you do the same for a child who wasn't biologically yours? And all the evidence I've seen, and I have personal experience as well, my godson is adopted from Romania, his sister from Vietnam, is that adoptive parents can form bonds that are so strong with these children that they will go to any lengths to look after them and nurture them and love them. And I suppose I'm a believer that that biology isn't everything, that actually incredible bonds can be made between people. And it's something that comes up again and again in my books, is how people come together who have perhaps no drop of blood in common, no background in common, and yet they form a family of sorts. And that's something that's a wider issue, I think, in modern life, where families are fragmented and separated and blended, that we're forging these new relationships. You know, as an immigrant to America from England, I'm trying to forge a new family for myself, or an extended family. And I was sort of adopting, you know, aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins for my children here. And some of those go really, really deep. So yes, the lengths you would go to for a child, whether he is biological or not, I think is an issue at the heart of the book. And my impression is that if you are a parent, you will do just about everything for your child.
Part of this novel is told through Jonah's perspective, who's 7 at the start. He turns 8 by the end of it. How do you, as a writer, go about inhabiting the perspective of someone so young?
So this is one of my favorite things that I do in many of my adult novels. I kicked it off with my first novel, What Milo Saw, which is told predominantly through the eyes of a small boy as well.
The boy is slowly going blind in that novel, right?
He is. And it was considered a bit of a crossover novel, a little bit like Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. I don't know if that
Mark Haddon's novel about the autistic boy.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which was pitched to both adults and young adults and even children. The reason I love writing from the point of view of children, well, first of all, I feel that they need to have a voice. If the story is about family and is about them, they need to have a voice. And I think that's very important. But also because they have this magical view of the world that I think is hugely engaging for a reader. It's sometimes a little bit of a naive view. It's a view that's incomplete. And as a reader, you see the world through their eyes. And they're both very hopeful sometimes, but also they have this incomplete knowledge. And if you're into geeky terms, there's a term in literature called the ironic gap, where you know more about what's going on in the narrative and the story than the character who is telling the story. And with children, that's almost always the case. If you're a grown-up, you know more about what's going on in Jonah's life than Jonah does, because he has a limited perspective, because he's much younger. And so that makes for quite a powerful reading experience. I also think children add a bit of light. So the subjects that I tackle in my books are quite strong social issues. And I think they can sometimes become a bit preachy or a bit heavy if they're exclusively told through adults. Children add a bit of humour and a bit of light to that. And I find it fun. I think I mentioned in my book recommendations Room by Emma Donoghue, which is told through the eyes of a five-year-old boy in completely horrific circumstances. He's locked in a room. He's been kidnapped with his mother. And yet he brings the most magical perspective of the world and that room because he is a child. So it's something I love to do.
Mm-hmm. How does a novel come together for you? Do you know the whole plot from the beginning? Do you plot it out, or do you sort of just follow the story as it goes along?
So I usually am interested in a subject. So I knew for a while that I wanted to write about the subject of modern adoption. And then I sometimes have a triggering event, or I find out about a particular situation that tells me, wow, that's going to be the opening of my novel. And for this one, it was when I was talking to one of the social workers, and she said to me, that she worked for Heathrow Airport, and that quite often children were shipped from third world countries or less privileged countries with a chance of a new life in, say, England or America, and that there was the expectation they would be met by a family member, and yet no one's there to pick them up. And then obviously they get picked up by social services because they're children, and they get swept into the adoption service. And I suddenly had this vision of a little boy lost at Heathrow Airport on Christmas Day, having been abandoned by the person who brought him over, and no one there to pick him up, and what would happen then. And so that opening scene to me was a sort of microcosm of the novel as a whole, and it triggered the drama. And so very often I get an almost cinematic picture of what the opening needs to be. And from there, I work forward. I have to say that I do have to plot quite far in advance from quite a pragmatic point of view. Editors these days want you to submit a full synopsis of a story as a proposal. And they debate that with everyone else in the publishing team before they decide to acquire the book. And so my very first book, Milo, I could just present the whole book and say, would you like to have this book? And so I got to completely choose, you know, the plot and so on. And here it's more of a discussion. So I'll put forward a proposal with the synopsis, and then there might be a bit of debate with my editors and publishers and agent as to which elements, you know, will work or won't work. So usually I do have to know quite a lot in advance.
Do you prefer one method over the other?
I think it's a really healthy discipline to really map out in detail what you think is going to happen. Now, my publishers don't expect me to keep to it completely. When I actually come to putting the magic on paper and writing the scenes, then I can change things according to the demands of that story. And for me, I think it gives me a degree of security, and I think it forces me to write a good story and to write good plot rather than to just meander. And writers can be quite navel-gazing and fall in love with their own language and their own quirky ideas and go off on tangents. And so it's a good way of focusing, I think.
Well, Virginia McGregor, thank you very much for coming in and speaking to me about Before I Was Yours.
Oh, it's a complete pleasure. Thank you.
That's Virginia McGregor. Her latest book is called Before I Was Yours, and you can find a list of Virginia's top five reading recommendations at our website, nhpr.org. Have you read a good book lately? If so, let's hear about what you've been reading. Tell your fellow listeners which books to track down by sending an email to us The address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at NHPR Bookshelf. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.